The Ayore of Bolivia is a group of Indians, I guess you would call them. We are now moving into the 1940s. So I'm not sure that anyone in here would remember that firsthand. But what we're going to be learning about is a group of men, Bob Dye, his brother Cecil, Dave Bacon, George Hosbach, and Eldon Hunter. What else is going on right now in the big world? Not right now, at that point, 1942. Pretty big thing called the World War II. These men are on a mission for the Lord. And this is actually the first team sent out by New Tribe Missions. They're going to Bolivia. There's a larger team that went down, and while they're getting to Bolivia, the Lord gives them success, and they actually see about 100 people come to know the Lord. These five men, though, have heard about the Ayore, who have also been called the Barbaro, the Barbarians. And they are concerned for this group of people. People describe the Ayore as a tribe that uses short arrows with such deadly effect that even the neighboring tribes are terrified of them. The team was warned that the Ayore attack any civilized person who comes near them, that they were impossible to tame, and that you won't come back alive, and that they'll club their victims in the hammocks at night. Okay, so it's not a welcome committee there waiting for them. The team, however, was unaffected, and they were determined to reach this tribe, and so they set out into what they called the Green Hell, the jungles there. They had weapons with them to protect themselves against jaguars and that sort of thing, and for hunting, but they had made up their minds to send the weapons home as soon as they found themselves near the Ayore. Not wishing to risk killing any Ayore. So when they finally found a creek, found a creek that they believed the Ayore used, they sent their guns home. Bacon, Cecil and Bob Dye, George Hosbach, and Eldon Hunter pressed forward, hoping to tell the Indians about the Jesus who left majesty to die for them. Cecil told the two men who were taking the guns back, if you don't hear anything inside a month, you can come search for us. That was 42. It was 8 years before anyone heard anything about what happened. By that time, they presumed they were dead. All five were killed in attempting to give the gospel. One of their co-workers who didn't go, named Joe, actually worked very hard to make contact with the Ayore. The Ayore came, they enticed them to come out of the jungle actually to a settlement on the edge there, and they made friends. And in 1950, an Ayore man who had been present at the killing of these men told what happened. He said that the missionaries had walked into an Ayore camp and left gifts in front of the surprised natives. So I guess they just kind of walked right in, followed them. One warrior wanted a bigger gift, and he didn't get it, so the five gospel bearers were killed. Like that. The chief was away at the time, and upon his return, he rebuked his men for the killing. He said, clearly the white men were not enemies, and he buried them in the camp. So these men were killed, not in opposition. We're in the opposition aspect of this lesson. It's not so much that these Indians hated the gospel, so they killed these men. It's that these men were different. They were outsiders, and so they were killed. Were their deaths a waste? Other New Tribes missionaries, whom they knew, looked at them as five seeds. As Cecil Dye had written before his death, he said this, perhaps more Christians at home would become more aware of their responsibility to lost men and less concerned over the material things of this life if the expedition failed and we lost our lives. And you can read their story in a book called God Planted Five Seeds. God Planted Five Seeds. And this is just falling into this a concept of Christ has built His church even in the face of opposition. This is opposition. It was opposition that may have been more culturally and societal oriented, but these people did not want the missionaries coming. They killed them, and it's not a waste, though. And what I found interesting about this is that this is only about a decade before another group of five men were killed. We know much more about them and God's providence, or at least I did. I didn't know much about this team. So I thought it'd be interesting to kind of bring out these men who gave themselves out of love for these people and who lost their lives and left family members behind. And this is a plaque, actually, in Bolivia. I just found this. I found a guy who does a little bit of blogging, and it ends up he is the son of missionaries who went in right after these guys did. So it's kind of interesting. He had this picture up there. It's in Spanish, and it has their names on there. They're evangelical missionaries and martyrs, all of them from the United States of America. 1943, December, they were killed, and then has John 15:13. No greater love has any man than this, but that he lays down his life for his friends. So that's a pretty neat testimony, I think, to the Lord's working, even in opposition. That brings us to our third, Christ will build his church in spite of flawed servants. And I want to say up front, it is not my goal to tear down anybody. Okay? I am not picking at men. It's not my intention at all. These are all men who love the Lord and who have served Him. Though I had a friend who used to, he said he hated reading missionary biographies because too often they fell into the hagiographa type phase where all you thought these were perfect people. and it's like, well, there's no room for me then, because if only holy and superbly excellent people can serve the Lord, then there's no room for me. That's not the case. God uses all people. So please do know, I am not trying to cut down people. What I want us to do, though, is to be realistic and to learn and to glorify the Lord from this. So, number one, Carl F.A. Gutzlaff. He was born in Germany, 1803, and he trained at Moravian schools. This man was brilliant. He was very gifted. He published 61 books in various languages, including several translations of the New Testament. He had a mind on it. He began as a missionary, then he started working for the East India Company. And this is what Mrs. Howard Taylor wrote about him in the biographies about William. Not William either. Let me get my mind on straight here. Hudson Taylor. Though not strictly speaking a missionary, and he worked for the East India Company, he lived for one thing only, that is, the extension of the kingdom of God. To this he devoted his large salary, his remarkable powers of mind and body, and all his available time. He wrote and published 80 works in no fewer than 8 different languages, including a translation into the Chinese of both the Old and New Testaments. This was a gifted man, a very gifted man. He began his adult life as a missionary. His first assignment was in Indonesia, where he served for 2 years. He left there to go to Thailand with his young family to be missionaries. And it's there that he decided to adopt the native dress and lifestyle of the people he was trying to reach. And that was a pretty bold move. at that point in time. If you remember, Hudson Taylor took a good bit of flack for doing that later on. His work day was cut short. He had to leave because of illness and the fact that both his wife and daughter died while he was there. So he is suffering and serving the Lord. But at that point, he gained a real desire and vision for reaching China. He is a contemporary of Robert Morrison and Liang Afa, whom we already met. Beginning in 1831, Gutzlaff began making tours along the Chinese coast, also making stops at Korea and Formosa. He tried to give the gospel verbally, but primarily he gave out literature. And you have to remember, at this point in time, China was not open. There were only five ports that Westerners were allowed to be in, and they really weren't supposed to proselytize at this point. He used any vessel he could get, be it a Chinese junk or an illicit opium clipper. And we don't want to be too harsh, but choosing to go on a drug boat may not have been the best best mode of transportation. He even engaged himself as a mate on a Chinese junk and another time as a cook in order to visit places to which no foreign vessels sailed and obtain opportunities for making known the truth as it is in Jesus. This man was motivated. Okay, he was going to be a cook on a boat if that meant he could get the gospel out. He was motivated. His skill with the language enabled him to go inland in 1833, and he did really well until the Opium War of 1839. That war was between China and England. China wanted to keep the opium out. England wanted their profit. It's a sad chapter in history there. During the Opium War, he served as a translator and helped negotiate the Treaty of Nanking. In 1842. After the treaty was signed, he settled in Hong Kong to work out his master plan. His master plan was to reach inland China by training Chinese evangelists. And he's smart, he's motivated, and he wants to accomplish this. So he begins this. Within 6 years, he had recruited 300 evangelists who reportedly gave out thousands and thousands of Bibles and other pieces of literature. There were reports of at least 2,871 credible conversions in China. In 1849, he decided to return to Europe for a tour. And he was quite the hit. He came back and people flocked to listen to him. He really was a star. In 1850, though, while he was in Germany, his bubble burst. The whole endeavor turned out to be a grand hoax perpetrated by his Chinese workers, most of whom were thoroughly dishonest. The literature, instead of being distributed, was sold back to the printers, who then resold it to Gutzlaff. The tales of converts and baptisms were fabricated, and the money that had been so sacrificially donated had quickly found its way to the black market opium trade. And then when you read on about this man, Tucker goes on to say, as shocking as the news was to his supporters, Gutzlaff himself, as evidence indicates, was aware of the shady state of affairs before he left China for his European tour. This is her comment. Pride apparently compelled him to protect his own reputation and to turn his back on the mounting evidence. And so another historian of missions says, Gutzlaff may be variously judged as a saint, a crank, a visionary, a true pioneer, and a deluded fanatic. He goes on to conclude that this was perhaps the worst of the not infrequent fiascos with which the history of missionary work is studded. And Taylor, who wrote the Hudson Taylor's biography, she's pretty positive about him, Gutzlaff. she said Gutzlaff sadly lacked common sense and that discernment of the spirits so necessary. In a word, he had been systematically swindled. And this really scuttled his boat, you can imagine. He was heartbroken. And he left. He went back to China vowing to make things straight. And he died before he really got a chance. And my point up here is not to say he was a fraud. He wasn't. We all know what it's like when you have a desire. You might not immediately want to recognize all of the facts that might be coming up. But his life, God used him. Christ used him to reach China. So I'm going to read you some of these things. To some, he remained a hero, and out of his missionary efforts was born the Chinese Evangelization Society, the organization that commissioned Hudson Taylor to China in 1853. Gutzlaff, more than anyone else, influenced the missionary methods and goals of the enthusiastic young Taylor, and in later years, Taylor referred to him as the grandfather of the China Inland Mission. Okay? His influence is great through Taylor. Gutzlaff's work was not wholly in vain. He had made men aware of the 18 provinces and had brought two great societies into the work in China. One of his colleagues, Rudolf Gleckler, served for more than 50 years and was still in China when the 20th century dawned. And this is what Taylor says, Mrs. Howard Taylor. Burning with love to Christ and zeal for the advancement of his cause, Dr. Gutzlaff had returned from Hong Kong a few months previously and had commenced in London as starting point, a missionary crusade of the most remarkable kind. From Ireland to Hungary, he passed, proclaiming in all the leading capitals of Europe the duty of the Christian church toward the unevangelized millions of China. For the first time, the need and claims of that great land came home to many a heart, with the result that multitudes were on their knees praying as never before. Someone else comments, and yet had Gutzlaff failed, his plans miscarried grievously and his projects came to nothing. But prayer and faith cannot fail. More perhaps than any man in his day, he had seen the commanding vision, China won for Christ, and had given himself his all to bring it to pass. Long years after, when the China Inland Mission had become a fact in all the inland provinces, its founder loves to refer to Dr. Gutzlaff as, in a very real sense, the father of the work. Okay? It's a bit of a sad story. I mean, he thinks things are going great, and he is being swindled. Perhaps evidence tells us that maybe he did not want to see the reality of being swindled. But in the end, God used him. His taking on the dress of the natives influenced Hudson Taylor. His desire to reach into the interior where the Westerners weren't allowed to go influenced Taylor. And God used Taylor and many, many others to reach millions of people with the gospel. And so God works even through flawed people to accomplish his work. And Christ still built his church, even though he's dealing with us, flawed people. Grandfather of China Inland Mission. Our next one is going to be Alexander Duff. Does anybody know where he is and where he was in history? Good. Do you want me to tell you? We're all looking a little tired, so I'm going to take a little break here. Alexander Duff was a missionary to India. Scottish missionary to India. He was actually the first foreign missionary sent out by the Church of Scotland. He was a very brilliant man, very smart, loved scholarship. And on his way to India, he was actually shipwrecked twice. And in the process, he lost his entire library. A crushing blow. Terrible thing. Makes me scared to even ship my library on a plane. What if it goes down? No, it was a crushing thing for him. One who was so consumed with scholarship and education. He had a vision. And his vision was to reach out not to the outcast, but to the Brahmin caste, the highest caste of people. He is a somewhat of a contemporary with William Carey. It's reported that Duff was one of the last people to speak to Carey. And I don't know if you've heard the story, but Dr. Duff was talking to Dr. Carey about all the things he'd done. And as he walked away, Carey said, "Come back." And he said, "You've been talking about Dr. Carey this and Dr. Carey that. After I'm gone, just talk about the Lord. Don't talk about Dr. Carey." And that was Dr. Duff. His vision was for reaching India through the Brahmin classes. He sought to win the Brahmins, and through them, who were presumably the natural leaders of the land, all India, by schools in which the best of Western learning, superbly taught, would be combined with an ardent Christian faith. And so that's what he did. He began a school under a tree with 5 students. And by the end of the week, he had between 200 and 300 students. Yeah, whoa. the kids came flocking. And it seemed like things were going great guns. He was teaching, doing well, and between August of 1832 and April 1833, 4 young men became Christians and were baptized. So, I mean, this is good news. Well, such a thing had never happened before of the in a Brahmin caste, and the commotion was immense. All the students went away. Their parents were not pleased. For a time, the whole work was threatened, but the school's merits were such that it gradually regained the confidence of the public, and the school went from strength to strength. All the students returned, so that after a decade of this school being open, their enrollment averaged around 800. Okay, so his goal is to educate, and he has 800 students a year. The Lord really is giving him an opportunity. Duff had 33 converts in 18 years of work. All right, so not a ton, but he had some converts. But all of the converts were of sterling quality and became the founders of some of the most notable Christian families in India. The major criticism of Duff's work was that the vast majority of his students came to his school only for the secular education. And of these thousands, there were only 33 recorded converts. But most of these 33 were young men from influential families who themselves became influential Christians. Some of them served as missionaries and ministers, and others became prominent Christian leaders. Okay, so he wants to reach out through the intelligentsia of the high class, and through them, because they're the leaders, reach out, and he does this work. The Lord used him outside of India, because during his second furlough, he toured England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and the United States. And everywhere he went, he was highly acclaimed. When he got to the U.S., he actually spoke to Congress, and he met with the president in a private meeting. Okay? He has been described as the most eloquent missionary orator of his century. And his impact on foreign missions was significant. Through his influence, hundreds volunteered for foreign missionary service, and tens of thousands contributed to the cause. His concept of combined education and evangelism was copied the world over, despite the controversy the method frequently aroused. So here's a man who has worldwide influence, not just in India, but all over. And the Lord is using him to call out people, both to contribute toward missions and to go as missionaries. Or what is his flaw? Well, he failed as a father. This one stuck out to me, and that's why I chose to do him. In 1839, he and his wife returned to India after their first furlough, leaving their four little children, including their infant boy, behind with a widow lady, and they did not return until 1850 when that little boy was 11 years old. It was a time remembered with mixed emotions. This kind of tells you what kind of guy Duff is. Wasting no time to drill his son on his catechism, Duff rebuked him when he wasn't pleased and said, "The heathen boys in my institution in Calcutta know more of the Bible than you do." Okay. The Duff stayed home for 5 years and they left again for India in 1855. Their teenage son recalled the following, "I well remember how my mother's and my own heart were well nigh breaking, and how at the London Bridge my father possessed himself of the morning times and left us to cry our eyes out in mutual sorrow. And so we parted. A sadder parting as between mother and son there never was. The father, buried in his times, parted from the son without any regret on the latter's part." It about broke my heart when I read that. And I know that we have to look and see that we live in a different era. There were dangers, I'm sure, in India, as well as the desire to see his children reared in a Western way and have a good upbringing. But what it comes across to and what his son describes in this book is a man who was very distant and who was not involved emotionally in the life of his child. Now, does that neutralize all the good that God did through Alexander Duff? No, obviously not. Is that a failure? Yes, because he should have been a father to his children. And what I want to bring out is that, again, Alexander Duff, on the one side, looks like an incredible missionary statesman. Brilliant, driven, useful. But we don't know, that's not the only thing that he was. He also failed in a very large part of the ministry God had given him as a father. George Grenfell. Any of you know who George Grenfell is? I did a pretty good job picking these guys out, huh? I didn't know who they were. I figured. George Grenfell was an English missionary to the Congo, now Zaire. He was inspired by Livingston, and he was drawn to Africa in the wake of Livingston's death. It was actually through reading Livingston's first book that Grenfell committed himself to African missions. He was trained. He had a trade that he actually worked for a while before he submitted himself to the Baptist Missionary Society. They appointed Grenfell to Cameroon in 1875. His bride, Mary Hawks, died shortly after their arrival. So he is suffering and sacrificing for the sake of the gospel. He served a 3-year apprenticeship in the Cameroons and then was assigned to do pioneer work on the Congo River, following on the discoveries of Stanley's 999-day journey. It's the Stanley who said, "Dr. Livingston, I presume." He went back and served there. It was Grenfell's hope to pave the way for a network of mission stations across Africa. His mode of travel was a river steamer called the Peace. Catch up here. Called the Peace, which he actually assembled himself after 3 engineers who were sent one at a time to carry out the task died. So a lot of people are dying in the Congo here. It's rough on the constitutions of the Europeans. And he was actually one of 2 men who opened the Congo, that is modern Zaire, for missionary work in 1877. So he's a pioneer missionary whom God is using. He is willing to sacrifice, as we saw with the death of his wife just after they arrived. Cannibalism, slavery, virulent virulent disease, war, and an antagonistic Belgian colonial regime were among the major obstacles Grenfell dealt with during his life in the Congo. He was known as a peacemaker who believed that the Bible translations in local languages and educational work were essential for a successful missionary effort. And he worked amidst danger and deprivation. He recalled as many as 20 harrowing experiences of running away from cannibals. And this is how he described them. The people are wild and treacherous. For several times after a period of apparently amicable intercourse, without any other cause than their own sheer cussedness, as the Yankees would say, they let fly their poisoned arrows at us. Okay, so doesn't know what's going to happen, always got to watch your back, that kind of living. Despite these circumstances, Grenfell continued on in his missionary work, supervising the Baptist missions in Congo for 20 years. Can you imagine 20 years in that kind of environment? With surprising success. In 1902, he wrote, "You will be glad to know that here at Bulobo, shorthanded as we are not without evidence of progress and blessing. People are more willing to hear and give heed to the message they have so long slighted. In fact, many are professing to have given their hearts to the Lord, Jesus. And there are signs of good times coming." And growth did take place. Soon there was a need for a larger chapel. He told of how 20 years before he had been driven off by spears, but now was greeted with the singing of "All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name." Isn't that quite the change? It's exciting to see. But he left a mixed legacy with his 30 years. This is a time of colonialism. The Belgian king kind of viewed Congo as his backyard, basically. And he wanted rubber. And these people were his slaves. And it sounds pretty gruesome. I know at one point, there's another missionary there, William Shepherd from the U.S. He was a black Presbyterian sent. And he saw a pit or a fire with a grate over the top. And it had 81 right hands on it being baked or cooked, whatever, to be sent back to the king. And because the king had a morbid, very evil personality, and he was collecting hands. So it was bad. It was very, very bad. Kind of makes you not wonder why they might kill you because you're white and you represent everything. Everyone who was hurting them. Although Grenfell had seen firsthand the full range of abuses, including Leopold's state employees buying chain slaves, he was mostly silent. In a letter home, he wrote that he was hesitant to publicly question the action of the state. Later on, this Shepherd, this William Shepherd, a black missionary from the States, was actually... He was told he couldn't go to the States unless a white man with him went with him to be his superior. And so, this is back in the 1800s, okay? So you're looking at a lot of some bad sin. So Shepherd was sent along with Samuel Lapsley, and those two guys got along great. They were good friends. And Lapsley met up with Grenfell, and he had a pretty bad experience. And this was his relating his experience. He said Grenfell hated the natives, and they hated him. They had even threatened him with murder. Was this what it meant to be a missionary, hiding in your fancy house, terrified that the people you'd pledged to help might shoot you in the head? And Lapsley's concerns were reinforced later when he encountered refugees from Grenfell's steamship, the Peace. These refugees were disoriented and starving. And according to the refugees, they had run off after having been starved and then whipped. Without enough rations, the Peace, his steamship, had become a floating torture chamber with hungry white men beating even hungrier black men. It's a sad thing. Terribly sad. And I appreciate what Tucker said. She said, no responsible historian would say that Grenfell went to Congo to abuse. What happened, though, was that he did not stand up for what was right and became overwhelmed as he stood between the people and the state. He found himself in the difficult position of seeing government abuses. The Congo was considered the private domain of King Leopold of Belgium. And Tucker goes on to say, his years in the Congo corresponded with the increasing atrocities against Africans, atrocities that were happening all around him. But he was not willing to go public with what he knew or even to protect the villages against encroaching state men. It's no wonder some of the Africans wanted him dead. Okay? And this is a blight on Christian missions. If you look at history, there was a lot of this going on. There was the colonization efforts. Many of these people were looked down on as not even being really human or subhuman, and so they were mistreated. And unfortunately, even though in a lot of cases missionaries did speak out, missionaries were still associated with the Western powers who did that. But even despite that, the Lord built His church through the work of His Holy Spirit using the word, the gospel. And my desire is not to tear down missionaries, but to say, listen, we've made big mistakes in the past, but God has still done what He said He would do. Jesus has kept His word and built His church. And so now, Christianity really is growing in Africa, despite the way we messed up a long time ago. Okay, that is the end of that kind of downer section. Let's move on to some brighter stuff, right? Christ will build His church through unlikely servants. This is my favorite part, so I hope you'll enjoy it as well. First one is Betty Olson from the 1960s. Does anyone remember her name? Okay. All right, good. And I'm going to quote Tucker. Betty Olson did not fit the profile for a missionary hero. Many who had known her in her earlier years doubted her usefulness in missionary service altogether. Okay? She did not shine as a child. In the least. She had experienced a difficult time of rebellion as a young person. She was born to missionary parents serving in Africa. Her earliest recollections were of her parents consumed in the work of the mission, often away for days at a time visiting African churches. When she was 8 years old, she was sent away to school for 8 months each year, where she spent many homesick nights crying herself to sleep. For her, boarding school was not a pleasant experience. So again, you have the whole idea of parenting associated with mission work. And she rebelled against the rules and resisted close relationships with others, fearing the hurt that would inevitably come when separations occurred. Her insecurities as a teenager were only exacerbated when, just before her 17th birthday, she lost her mother to cancer. She went back to the States, finished high school. She went to college in Brooklyn to study for nursing, and then she went to the missionary school, NIAC, to train for missionary service. But by the end of her time at NIAC, her spiritual struggles really intensified. And she wrote that she remembers telling the Lord, if this is all there is to the Christian life, then I don't want it. And instead of receiving help from counselors, it seems like they glossed over the root issues and only led to more and more frustration for her. She still kind of had this desire, though, to serve the Lord as a missionary, so she didn't think the Christian Missionary Alliance would send her. That's who she was with. So she went back and joined her father and her new stepmother in Africa working. It was a difficult time, however. She could not suppress her anger, and after a time, she became so difficult to work with that she was asked to leave. She found herself back in the States and in Chicago. She was 29 years old, and she was on the brink of suicide. Someone introduced her to a man named Bill Gothard, who was counseling the youth at a church, and she talked with him, and the Lord really used him to root out the rebellion in her life, and she submitted to God, and really saw a large change. And later on, Bill Gothridge said that he developed his institute in basic youth conflicts based largely on the questions Betty Olson asked. I thought it was kind of interesting when I was reading through her biography here. And she now really wanted to serve the Lord, and she was sent to a leper colony in Vietnam beginning in 1964. What was going on in Vietnam in the 60s and prior to that and after? The conflict, right? First with the French, and then we got involved as a nation. So she's sent there to work in a leper colony, and I'm thinking, wow, in the middle of a war, you're working with lepers. Talk about a sacrificial spirit. She said, most of the people that I have told about going to Vietnam are greatly concerned, and I appreciate this. However, I am not concerned, and I am very much at peace. I know that I may never come back, but I know that I am in the center of the Lord's will, and Vietnam is the place for me. Okay? She was there during the time of the Tet Offensive. The Viet Cong tried to wipe out the Christian missionary influence in Dai Lạc province. Over a three-day period, they attacked the hospital compound several times, killing multiple missionaries. On February 1st, 1968, she, a man named Henry Blood, who was a translator, and a man named Mike Benj, who was working for the government, were taken captive. They were forced to hike 14 hours a day through the insect-infested jungle with very meager rations. Blood was a translator, and so it was not long before his body, that was used to a sedentary lifestyle, couldn't handle it, and he passed away. The Viet Cong continued to push Olson and Benj mercilessly. Benj contracted cerebral malaria and nearly died. He credits Olson with keeping him alive. She forced him to rouse from his delirium to eat and drink water and rice soup. She nursed him throughout his sickness. Several times, she gave him some of her food allotment, pretending that she could not eat it all. Mike recalls that it was her spiritual strength that got him through. She prayed twice a day for him, he recalled. They kept up this pace. I mean, just think about it. 12 to 14 hours a day in a jungle on meager rations. They began to have a lot of the symptoms of malnutrition. All their body hair fell out. Their teeth began to loosen and their gums bled. A lot of gruesome things. She got to the point where she was so sick that she couldn't move and the Viet Cong would beat her. Trying to get her to move. And this Benj guy tried to protect her as best he could. But she finally succumbed to the abuse and died on September 26, 1968. So from February 1st to almost the end of September, she endured this. It's a long time. And the abuse was terrible. Benj buried her and vowed to stay alive. And he was taken to a camp referred to as the Land of Milk and Honey by the communists. And although he was only 33 years old, the POWs at the camp guessed that he was over 70 years old due to the emaciation that he experienced, and then all his hair had turned white. And I just tell you that to let you know, this was incredible physical suffering. As a result, I mean, there's a lot of politics going on, too, but they were trying to get rid of Christianity in that province. And this is where I thought it was just really neat. Mike Benj told how he himself put his trust in God through Olson's and Blood's selfless witness to him. He told how they hid their own meager rations to share with captured native Christians whose rations were even less. In Olson, the once angry young woman who was asked to leave the mission field because she was too much of a pain. In her, this is what he said, I found the most unselfish person I'd ever known. Her love was more than he could comprehend. He said she never showed any bitterness or resentment. To the end, she loved the one who mistreated her. Isn't that beautiful? An angry girl couldn't stay because she was such a pain. And here she is, through her testimony, this man Mike Benge became a Christian. Who knows the others who have been influenced by her life? Because the Lord changed her by His grace. She was an unlikely candidate to be used by Christ. But He did it anyway. Because He is going to build His church, like He said. She died in 1968. Elkah of the YY. Anyone heard of him? No? Christ's Witch Doctor? Have you heard of that book? I had not. I bought it for $2-something, just over $2 on the internet, and with shipping it was just over $5. And I read it in 2 days. It's easy reading. Very interesting. So, it's called Christ's Witch Doctor. This is probably my favorite story, so we're going to end with it. So we're almost there, I promise. Elkah was one of the YY tribe, and they lived in the British Guiana. Okay, that's supposed to be showing you where that is, if you can make that a little better. It's up there at the top of South Africa, South America there. YY was a very spiritual kid. He was very much interested in the spirits of his tribe. And by the time he was in his early teens, he was on the way to becoming a witch doctor for his tribe. He wanted to do good for his people. And so he wasn't like a real dark, ugly witch doctor, but he believed and worked with the spirits of his local tribe. The Lord sent Neil and Baba Hawkins to the YY in 1949. They came up, they were feared and distrusted at first, because news had gotten out that the white killers were coming. And so they were very nervous about them coming, but they came and they were faithful in their work. They asked the YY for help in learning the language, and also, because the language had no written, the YY language was not a written language, the Hawkins did the work of creating a written language and translating the Bible. And here's a time where God took someone who would seem to be an unlikely candidate, like a witch doctor, and used him. Because this witch doctor was very serious about the spiritual. He wondered what was going to happen next. And also, the Lord had brought him to the point where he was questioning his magic because a child had died. And he said, what's going on? Are these spirits weak or what? Well, he was very much attracted to God's paper, the Bible, because all of his messages from the gods came through vision. And he was beginning to distrust these visions and wonder, how do I really know? Am I interpreting it right? Because there's a lot about pigs and anacondas and stuff like that. And the fact that it had been written down, that if he could just learn to read those scratches on the paper, he could actually know what God said. He was very much attracted. He quickly became fascinated with the Bible, and we'll skip here. He worked really hard to learn to read. Very, very hard. But his conversion was not easy because he was torn, because he was a witch doctor. And here was this new God. And here was his old way of life. And here was a different way of life he was being taught. And so it was a long, difficult struggle. And for a while, he actually tried to do both. So he would blow on his rocks and do the witchcraft stuff and then pray after it. And try to have, you know, one foot on each side. But he knew that he couldn't do that. And after after a time of struggle, he turned to God in Christ. Now, I want to read you this prayer. It really is a beautiful prayer from a man who's coming to God. He walked out into the middle of a field, and he looked up and he said, "Father in the sky, I want to know you. So make yourself known to me forever." What do you think about that? Old Elko wants you to come into the pit of his stomach, Father, and make his spirit strong. He sat on a charred log, still intact after the burning of so many seasons before, and he looked up. He no longer looked up. He spoke as if the one he talked to sat next to him on the log. And he said, "Here I am, Father. I'm a witch doctor. This is what I am. I'm a bad person, too. I get angry. I scold my wife. And I'm sad about those things. But this is the way I don't want to be. So my old being, take it out, Father. You can because your son died for my badness in order to take it away. Fix me to be another kind of person. I want to be like you." In contrition, the young Indian bowed his black crowned head, which even at this early hour was decorated with the downy white feathers of an eagle. And one by one he named his sins: hatred, lust, envy, foolish pride. And he said, quote, "This is the way I am, Father. Fix me to be like Jesus." And they said, "That's all I have to say at this time, Father." You had to learn just to say amen, I guess. Isn't that beautiful? And that's the gospel at work. Elka grew rapidly. Soon he was teaching his own people about Christ. He built a little desk, a little table, and he would sit it down, and people would come to him and learn about Christ. He took really a very brave action. He threw away his medicine bag. In that culture, everyone knew that once a witch doctor, always a witch doctor. If you got rid of your medicine bag, that meant the spirit would kill you. He did it. And everyone said, "You're dead." And they were watching. They were watching, waiting for him to die. And he started telling them, "No, I am not going to die." He said, "If I die, then don't believe in Jesus. But if I don't die, believe in Jesus." And he began to teach them. He lived without fear, testifying of Jesus' power of the spirits. Soon, several other men of his clan became Christians. It's really a very neat thing here. The YY Christian men soon began leading their own church. And the way it happened was that one of the missionaries came down with a sore throat on a Sunday morning. And he called the elders in and said, "What are we going to do?" And Elka said, "Well, I'd sort of like to preach." And he preached that day. And he did so well that from that point on, the missionaries never preached on a Sunday. They spent all week teaching the elders, and the elders taught on Sundays the people. Really was a very, very neat thing. So he turned from witchcraft to Christ. Soon, he was very concerned about his people, but soon he began to think of others outside his clan. He was concerned about the Waiwai who still lived across the high mountains on the Mapuera. He wanted them to learn the way of Christ that his people now knew. So as a chief, he sent his brother with a shim-shim. It's a string that had a lot of knots tied in it, saying, "In this many days, however many knots there were, come to our village and we'll get together." He sent a shim-shim to invite those on the other side to come and live with it, because this was how they could best learn God's ways. And they did. They invited multiple tribes to come and live with them, and their influence was growing. As the faith of the YY grew wider and deeper, they began to think less about themselves and more about the other tribes in the jungle around them. Just as the missionaries had come to the YY with the news about God, so the YY, one of the missionaries said, should carry the gospel to others. They had made a start by inviting the Shedua and the Mawayana people, very much like themselves, to come and hear the new way. The new way of life held great attraction. Nearly 15 men who had been village headmen or chiefs gave up their positions as headmen or chiefs in order to live under Elka's leadership. No fewer than a dozen witch doctors, renounced the Yahweh God when they learned that God's papers spoke against sorcery. So you see God doing something really neat here. The Weiwei, I think, sent out more teams of missionaries. One group ended up being stranded with a distant tribe for quite a long time. When they returned, the men had cut off their long ponytails. In the Weiwei culture, it was the manly thing to have your hair in a queue down to your waist. Yeah, kind of your sign of being a man and looking good, I guess. And they cut it off. And one time before, when a guy did this, everyone teased him and said he looked like a buzzard because he cut his hair real short. So I don't know. They wouldn't like me, I guess. And this was a serious thing for a Weiwei man to do. But Elka's brother explained. He said, the Weka men wanted us to cut off our pigtails and look like them. At first, we didn't want to. It would take many rain seasons to grow it long again. But then, we thought it was no sacrifice at all if by cutting off our hair, we could make the Weka know that because of Jesus, we love them. Isn't that something? That's a real challenge to me. God took this witch doctor, saved him, this witch doctor became a teacher and an evangelist to his own people. And then out of that clan, missionaries went out everywhere, reaching out to their own people, willing even to cut off their pigtails in order to reach them. This quotation inside the front page of our bulletin kind of summed it up. It's at the very bottom. The fact that this incredible worldwide expansion through missions was carried out by frail and simple human beings, backed by only a minority of Christians back home, only enhances the glory that must be given to God alone. So when we think about history and we say, well, God, Christ built his church through people who had imperfect theology. Christ built his church even though there was tremendous opposition. Christ built his church even using flawed servants, some of them with major flaws. Christ built his church using unlikely people. What should we end up thinking today? Well, one is we should praise the Lord Jesus because he has kept his word. He has built his church. And he is building his church. And then I'm encouraged by this. I am. Because Christ is going to build his church. Because I know my sinful patterns and habits. I know my weaknesses, some of them. And there are days when I'm like, there's no way. And I imagine you probably feel that way too sometimes. Well, if Christ has in the past worked through people like us, he will now and he will in the future. So we can take hope that Christ will build his church even through people like us. And we can be grateful for that and we can be humbled by that and we can be galvanized and motivated by that fact.